Welcome to Money Isn't Scary, a podcast for women to explore our fears around money and inspire each other to be financially empowered. I'm Megan Dwyer, and I'm making it my personal mission to remove the taboo around money and help women rewrite their stories so they can stop staying small and begin to live life on their terms. In this show, we get real and uncomfortable as we unpack our beliefs, thoughts, and behaviors that aren't serving us anymore. I can't wait for you to join me on this journey, so let's dive in. Hi, you guys. Welcome to another episode of the Money Isn't Scary podcast. I'm Megan Dwyer. Today, I'm chatting with Jill Siriani. Jill is a licensed clinical social worker and co-host of the top-rated Frugal Friends podcast, and she loves exploring the connections between money behaviors and mental health, which is why I knew that Jill and I would instantly hit it off. We are so aligned in our perspectives on many of the topics discussed today, and you'll see that one of the main themes that we just keep coming back to is this idea of curiosity and this non-judgmental self-awareness and just how key this is to creating a healthy relationship with money. I'm so excited to share this conversation with you all. Jen is just super cool, and she brings so much knowledge from her experience as a social worker into the conversation. I know you guys are going to love it as much as I do, but before we get into it, here's a little bit more about Jill. Jill Siriani is a licensed clinical social worker and natural-born frugalista. Her favorite frugal move was living in an RV to save on expenses and pay off student loans. When she's not making people laugh on Frugal Friends, you can find her digging in her backyard veggie garden or spending Saturday mornings at yard sales with her husband. Jill and her husband paid off $60,000 of debt by getting creative with their living situations and side hustles. They lived in an RV, house sat for a year, and have done some interesting side hustles like mobile bartending and flipping their RV. Now she co-hosts the Frugal Friends podcast to help people overcome their impulse spending and transform the habits that cause them to overspend. She's passionate about frugality and its intersection with money mindset. Aside from hosting over 300 episodes of Frugal Friends with 5 million downloads, she's featured in the Wall Street Journal, Kiplinger, The Penny Hoarder, and more for her work on the show. And in our conversation today, Jill and I talk about the journey of learning more about ourselves with that non-judgmental curiosity. We talk about the lingering effects that our personal narratives have on us, both in our money and in our mental health. We talk about money trauma and so much more. You guys can find more from Jill by checking out the Frugal Friends podcast, which she co-hosts with Jen Smith. And you can also go to their website, frugalfriendspodcast.com, and sign up for their free friend letter, which is a weekly email that shows freebies, savings hacks, money mindset shifts, all of the above. It's super cool. I subscribe. It's a lot of fun. So go check it out. All right, you guys, without further ado, here's my conversation with the incredible Jill Siriani. Enjoy. Hi, Jill. Welcome to the Money Isn't Scary podcast. Thank you so much for being here today.
Hi, Megan. Thanks for having me.
I'm really excited to talk to you. I think this is going to be such a fun conversation. So before we get started, I'd love to have you tell the audience a little bit about yourself and the work that you do.
Sure. So I am the co-host of the Frugal Friends podcast alongside Jen Smith. I am a licensed clinical social worker, and together we get to talk about personal finance, but looking at the whole person, bringing in my background in mental health. I have worked as a therapist and have done various things in the field of social work, as well as become debt-free alongside my husband on a social worker salary. So that's that experience is part of what drew me into podcasting, but bringing both the personal finance and mental health lenses to the table is certainly my sweet spot.
I love it. I love it. There's so much alignment in your podcast and my podcast and both of our passions. Can you tell us a little bit more about that story, that debt-free story that you had and what you went through with your husband?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I said, I have worked in the field of social work, still do a little bit less now. I focus on the podcast a little bit more, but I still maintain my licensure. And so when my husband and I first began our debt-free journey, I was the one who brought student loan debt into the partnership. Mm-hmm. And it was just a reality of, oh, this is real money. I didn't necessarily know that when I signed all the paperwork at 18. And
well, we weren't taught this in school, right?
So, right. Yeah. Go. Oh, yeah, exactly. I knew all about it and how it worked. And I was married young. And so it was this collective journey together of how do we get rid of it? And I, from pretty much the start, the second I was getting those letters in the mail that it's time now, your 6 months have passed and you need to start owing us back, I was very aware of that money, wanted it gone, but yet at the time was making $24,000 a year. Yeah. Granted, this was 12 years ago, still, that was not a lot of money then.
Right.
My husband was starting his own electrical business. So combined, we were not making more than $30,000, $35,000 a year. So when my student loan debt was $30,000 in total, that felt very overwhelming to me that this is just about the amount of money that I make in an entire year. How in the world am I going to pay this off? And so it took us 7 years. Now, this is a little bit, I'm becoming more and more vulnerable now over the years. So you're getting the full snapshot of the debt-free journey. I know a lot of people will talk about, here's the amount of money we began paying it off, and here's the amount of time it took. For us, it ended up taking us 7 years to pay off $60,000 of debt because we took on more loans and debt in that journey. So even though I was very aware of the debt, it felt heavy, I wanted it gone, it took us some additional steps to get there. So we had the $30,000 of student loan debt, but then we also took out vehicle loans for an RV, for a car, right? Yeah. And so it was this paying off, collecting a little bit more debt, paying off that debt and becoming entirely debt-free in those 7 years. And one of the big heavy hitters that really helped us, again, because we were making such low incomes, was looking at our biggest expenses, which was housing. And for many of us, that is the case. So my husband and I made the decision to live in an RV for a couple of years to pay down some of that debt. That was one of the loans we took out, but then we renovated the RV, lived in it for a few years, sold it, made a bit of a profit off of it. That made a huge difference in our ability to really take a stab at and tackle a lot of that debt. But still, you know, we're not making any headlines with this $60,000 in 7 years. That was a decent amount of time for it by many people's standards, maybe not a ton of money, but I think reflective of the fact that we weren't making a ton of money and kind of doing whatever we could to put extra money wherever we could find it towards this debt and finally getting there. But I think I appreciate that, just the slow, steady pace of it, and hopefully being able to speak to people who might find themselves in similar places where they're not making six-figure salaries and being able to have the headlines of, I paid it off in 6 months. Like, it can be done. And it can take a very long time depending on the season of life that you're in.
Yeah. And I think I agree with so much of what you said. I think there's two big pieces to this, right? There's like the intention piece and using your dollars in alignment with your priorities and your values and what matters, right? So like we said, during that time, you still had to live, right? Like you had to eat, you had to, you know, clothe yourself and make sure that you also like lived, like you still did the activities that you like to do and whatever that is. And you can't just like completely shut yourself off, right? So you have to have there's balance along with the intention. And then I think the other piece that I wanted to mention here too is like the shame, right? Like I think as a society, we often talk about, you know, being in debt as like it's this super bad thing. I think everybody is in debt. We just live in that kind of a culture. And debt actually isn't necessarily a bad thing as long as you know how to work it and use it and manage it appropriately. It actually can provide you with a lot of flexibility too. And this is stuff that I work with, you know, as a financial planner with my clients, is using debt to your advantage, right? And in a smart and manageable way. Yeah. But I think we have to also, you know, move through this idea that just because we have it, it's this like something that we should be fearful of or ashamed of, or, you know, we're bad people, or we're labeling or judging ourselves as a result of it, right?
I couldn't agree more. I think even Jen and I we've shifted in the 6 years of podcasting to saying more and more debt is neutral. I think our own experiences and seeing the way that it can benefit others, we can eyes wide open take on debt intentionally with a plan to be able to move us to a different place in life, to accomplish the goals that we want to accomplish. I think so often in the personal finance space, the narrative is, I was so unaware and then discovered my debt and I had this aha moment and then it took everything in me to tackle it. And that's not the case for everybody.
Right.
Sometimes it's, no, I knew, I was fully aware. I said yes to this debt. And made a plan for what it's going to do for me, what I'm comfortable with, what I'm not comfortable with, really kind of setting those boundaries. I think when we can know what we're saying yes to, it's a totally different story than I had no idea. I was just swiping my credit card or I was 18 signing papers. Like there can be different ways we step into it. But in any of the ways, I think dismantling the shame that's attached to it is so important.
Yeah, it's getting to like the underlying, like fundamental root of, you know, what's going on, right? And I think as a culture, again, we live in this world where more is better and we're always striving for like the next thing and comparing ourselves to other people. And I think there has to be kind of like a coming to terms with ourselves, like a slowing down and a recognizing like where are all these feelings coming from and what's underneath, like what's underlying all of it that's causing us to feel this way in the first place or causing us to react in that way or to compare ourselves. Is it, you know, this underlying insecurity or I don't know, something that the way you grew up, right? That like this belief that you have, right? That's causing it. I think that is really like that's so much of what I talk about on my show here is kind of getting to the root. And that is very much aligned with your background as a mental health professional, right? So I'd love to jump into that a little bit and talk more about how kind of mental health and money is aligned and the impact that money has on us and our mental health, because so many people don't even recognize that our beliefs about money and the way that we approach money on an everyday basis does have an impact to the way that we approach the world and the way that we think, right?
Yeah. Knowledge of ourselves is so powerful. Yeah. I think that's exactly what you're underscoring in what you've just described, that as we get closer and closer to knowing who we are, what makes us tick, our personhoods, it's going to benefit us in all aspects of life. We like to talk about how we're whole people, physical, emotional, spiritual, mental, relational, financial, all of these pieces make up a whole and each one is interconnected. We can't slice off one part of us and act like it's this thing out here that is disconnected from the rest. Whenever we make one decision in one area of our personhood, it's going to have a ripple effect on all other areas.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
I think this works for us. Sometimes it can work against us, maybe not exactly to our benefit. We can see how maybe when we make decisions that we don't love for our physical bodies, then we're going to feel it emotionally and mentally, maybe relationally. Similarly, when we make financial decisions that maybe we're very proud of, we're going to feel it emotionally, relationally, mentally, physically. So I think when we can use this and leverage it to our benefit, then all we need to do is focus on one area of ourselves at a time. I think I love to talk to people about when you are working on yourself relationally, you are helping yourself financially. You are helping yourself mentally, emotionally, because you are learning things that are going to benefit all those other, like when we learn boundaries relationally, it's only benefiting us and helping us to know boundaries financially. It's not like they're different. Like
How you do one thing is how you do everything. I talk about that all the time.
Yeah. And so I think where we can really begin or continue on. Most of us are on a continuing journey. We're not necessarily just starting. But when we can learn ourselves more, and we like to talk about being curious with ourselves, having this posture of curiosity where we're asking questions without assuming that we know the answers. And usually this curiosity is going to avoid questions of why. Not that there's any true issue with why. Why is ultimately neutral, but it can lead us to be on the defense if we're like, why did I just spend on that? Why am I doing it this way? Why do I always, whatever the case, instead, what is it about that thing that draws me to it? What is it about spending on this that fuels something inside of me? And getting curious, again, on all levels, it doesn't have to just be with finances, but the more we can know about ourselves, where we've come from, where we're at currently, where we say we want to go, the better equipped we're going to be to manage our finances if we're just looking at that aspect of our personhood. I think a lot of times we want to start with the behavior of impulsive of spending or sitting down and actually making a budget, but really it starts so much further back than that of what are my thoughts around money? What were my experiences with money growing up? How do I feel about the money I'm bringing in and the way that I'm spending it? This inner work that is less tangible, sometimes a little bit harder, little bit more like sand between our fingers. But yet those pieces are going to be what actually helps move the needle in when the actions come into play, because we don't begin with actions. We begin with thoughts and conversations and emotions, and then come the actions. So that's where we need to start too with our finances.
Yeah, totally, totally agree with that. I think there's a couple components to this, right? Like, I'm such a huge proponent for financial education and getting financial education into schools. And of course, like, we don't come out of school, like we just talked about, like we don't come out just automatically knowing these things. And I myself, on my journey, I knew nothing. I got my first credit card at a concert so I could get a free t-shirt. Like, and I remember, like, my parents and my sister, who's older than me and super smart, and always being like, okay, like, Megan doesn't really know anything about this stuff. And like, these are the beliefs that I internalized, right? And so then I got out into the real world and I realized, like, I know nothing. So I was sort of drawn to the financial profession because I just wanted to learn. And I certainly have come a long way, but I feel like when you're in that place, without having that financial knowledge and education, you can't come at this with a place of confidence and empowerment, right? So I think that's an important place to start.
Yeah, I think so often, I mean, it's beautiful that your not knowing led you to, well, let me figure it out. But for so many of us, especially when it comes to finances, our not knowing can keep us on the outskirts.
We can push it away.
Yeah. And I think because of some of the gatekeeping within the finance space and the jargon that can feel so unattainable, and sometimes people making us feel as though we're dumb for not knowing is like, okay, then I guess I'm just not good at this. I guess I'm just not good at money. I'll never know. It's overwhelming for me to think about. Yeah. And
I'm stupid. Let me just avoid it. Let somebody else do that. Right.
Yeah. For me, it was the voice, like hearing voices saying, no, you can learn this. You can pick up a book. You can listen to a podcast. However you like to learn, this isn't hard. I love your podcast. This isn't scary. It's okay.
Yeah.
There can be safe places that you can find to ask the questions that other people might make you feel dumb for, and to learn and to recognize, oh, it's actually not that difficult. And it is pretty simple. People just want to create jobs, I guess, and make it seem like it's complicated.
It's a culture thing too. I feel like, you know, it goes way back to, like, you know, women being oppressed. And again, we weren't allowed to have credit cards in our own names until 1974. And I think that, again, is a big reason why I think we suppress so many of our like natural emotions and kind of feelings around money. Of course, you know, the rationale, I guess, that women couldn't have credit cards until the 1970s was that women were more emotional and therefore were not deemed as rational as men were when it comes to money. Like we were considered not able to kind of too emotional to be able to handle it and manage it properly. And I feel like even though like I think about that all the time, like 1974, like my mom was a full-blown adult at that point. And we don't recognize, I think, even though my mom always worked and my mom was very involved in the finances, at least the day-to-day stuff, we don't recognize that kind of emotional burden gets passed down, right? Even though it's still in our culture. Like just because like the law changed doesn't mean that all of a sudden like our belief system, like our core belief system going back in history has changed. And I think we hold on to a lot of that subconscious like beliefs from generation to generation. So I think, you know, it at least now, you know, I just turned 40 and I've got young kids myself, and I think about how it's my job to change that story, right? And instead of pushing those emotions aside and saying like that there's not, and I think about this all the time, like how like my first job out of college and how many times I would like hide my emotions and go cry in the bathroom, right? Like like women do this all the time. We just hide it. We just pretend it's not there. How silly that is, and how we actually need to embrace those emotions because they're telling us something. They're leading us in a direction, you know, that we need to go. So I'm not saying go cry in front of all of your coworkers, but I am saying that it's important to pay attention to those things that are making us feel this way because they're telling us something.
Yeah, that's that curiosity piece of what is this telling me?
Right.
What is this thing that I'm experiencing? Because what you're saying, it's pointing to something a lot of times that we may not be consciously aware of, and revealing some of these things that are going on in our body, in our relationships, in our subconscious, that can be informative for how we're going to take wise next steps in all aspects of our personhood. I love what you're saying here about the impact and even some of the narrative in recognizing what was the context in which your mom, your grandmother grew up, and what lingering effects does that have on you now. I think these are all the questions we can talk about as it relates to money and mental health. There's this concept in social work called person in environment. PIE for short,
Okay.
because we love food acronyms. How else are we going to remember things? It's a very foundational concept. It's just this recognition of we are all people in an environment and a context. And looking at both of those things are going to be what helps us understand and be able to move towards, if it's us helping another person or us bringing in helpful resources for ourselves. It's this: who am I? What makes me tick? What do I value? Where have I come from? What are the decisions I've made? What's going on for me right now? And what is the context in which I'm living in? What's the season that's happening for me right now? Who are the close relationships that I have? Where have I come from? What is my family history and dynamic? And, you know, we can look at it specifically with money, but also what's happening within the community around me? What's going on with the economy? Are we currently experiencing a recession, a housing crisis? What's the job landscape looking like? Where, you know, what were the money experiences of my parents, and what were the laws around that? I think all of these things, as we look at person in environment, myself, and the context in which I'm living, it's going to shed so much light on why we do the things that we do, what's happening with us and our money decisions. And that those are the places that we can feel then so empowered towards good decision making around money and wanting to learn more about ourselves and what's going to be best for us in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. And what I'll add to that too is doing this all with an element of self-compassion. So, last year. This is one of my favorite episodes ever. I had Dr. Krista Neff on my show. She's the pioneer in self-compassion research, and she's just incredible. And she talks about these three components of self-compassion: kindness, mindfulness, and common humanity. And I think what you were just referencing has a lot to do with the common humanity aspect, which is by far the most important for me. It's like recognizing that we're in this together, right? So it's not just me, it's the context and the environment in which I am living in. There's a component of me, but let's know that we're all feeling this together. I am not isolated. I'm not on an island by myself. I'm not going through this totally alone. If I'm feeling this, somebody else has to be feeling this too. And that has really, since we had that conversation, that has really just like been such a universal concept in my life. And I talk about it when I talk about the stuff that I'm going through on my show as it relates to money, but also life, right? Like, because they're one and the same, our relationship with it. I really try to incorporate that universality of it and common humanity, that if I'm feeling this, somebody else out there must be feeling it too.
Yeah, we are impacted and impacting on a regular, like every single day. We have influence on others, and others have influence on us. And I think there again, so much power in recognizing that and then being able to leverage that in beneficial ways. There was a study done, and I forget who did the study, so take this loosely. I think there's been multiple on it, I think, at this point. But you know, that phrase, you are who you surround yourself by.
Yes.
This study was recognizing that it goes even beyond that. It's not just the people you're immediately surrounded by, but the 5 to 7 people they are surrounded by as well. Mm-hmm. Again, for better or worse, depending on kind of the lifestyle decisions that people are making, even what your friends are doing is going to have impact and influence on you. So I think recognizing that collective humanity piece can be really helpful in informing how do I want to show up and engage in the community and in which I'm in, and how can I, where I do have choice, choose who I am surrounding myself by as well, because that is a part of this journey. I'm only going to be able to make decisions so well, do so much, learn so much, go so far as the community in which I'm in and the choices that I'm making as far as relationships go and boundaries, and
right,
whether or not I am allowing that to be, you know, a positive beneficial force or maybe the opposite of that for me.
Right. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think, you know, one of the things I also wanted to get to that you talk about too is this concept of money trauma. And this is something that I have thought about, haven't really gone deep into at all on the show, but I want you to talk more about what exactly it is and how, you know, we work through it if we've been through it. But I also want to start by saying that if you've been through it, likely so many other people have been through it too, whatever the situation is. So you are not alone. And that is that whole common humanity piece that we were just talking about, right? So that helps to eliminate and reduce the shame. And what is, I love the Brené Brown quote on shame, that like, if you put shame in a petri dish, I forget exactly what it is, but it's it'll exponentially grow, right? So we have to be cautious of how we're thinking about that, how it's showing up in our lives, and be intentional around how we want it to show up in our lives, and is this holding us back, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I know trauma is a word. It has become a bit of a buzzword, unfortunately.
Yeah,
and
it has.
I feel for people who there's such a spectrum of traumatic experiences. So I don't want to be another voice just kind of throwing out the word for things that don't actually qualify as trauma.
Yeah.
And so to be able to define it clinically, trauma essentially is any event or experience that is or perceived to be life-threatening. So of course, this is, there's a wide spectrum on this. And I think sometimes colloquially, we will use it as something that is just a, maybe it feels like a crisis event in our lives, which I don't think is necessarily a wrong interpretation, but I think it's important to recognize the spectrum of traumatic experiences.
Right.
And so when it comes to trauma, or, you know, how we might say money trauma, I think this could encompass things, experiences that are or perceived to be life-threatening, depending on how someone interprets that. That is an important piece about trauma, is so much of being able to label it as such has to do with the perception of the individual who has experienced it.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we have money crises, money difficulties, money disparities, all sorts of things that are difficult when it comes to money experiences.
Yeah.
And there's no exact one size fits all of how we're going to respond or react to this. But I think first recognizing it and being able to process it is going to be important. So again, that still comes back to that curiosity with self, wanting to know, what have I experienced as it relates to money? What are some of my really positive, beneficial experiences? What in my money experiences have felt traumatic? What have felt like crises? What has been highly disruptive? What have been barriers in my life? I think what comes to mind is just kind of off the top examples, it could be divorce and the money difficulties that have come along with that. For many, I know, you know, from 2008 and on, housing foreclosures, yep. Bankruptcy.
Yeah.
I think we see in our community so many who have walked through this, and that is a traumatic experience because yeah. You don't necessarily know where your housing. I know for some people where money to put food on the table is going to come from. And that can be a really disruptive association then that we have with finances and can really inhibit and stunt where we go from there if we're not able to bring in some light, some gentleness,
yes.
Some resources, some helpful relationships, some
self-compassion, right?
Yeah.
Self-compassion, kindness, just, you know, you said nurture, like nurturing and education too.
Yeah. And so I think if we've found ourselves in these places with those types of experiences or any plethora of peripheral experiences to what we've just mentioned, again, it's going to start with our thoughts, our mental and emotional health before we can go to behavior. Our behaviors begin in our mind. And so we need to look at our thoughts and emotions surrounding our experiences before we can expect to see any type of action moving towards benefit or well-being for ourselves. And so this, depending on the severity of the money trauma, the money disruption, the money chaos that you've experienced in the past, for many, I recommend seeing a therapist, going to counseling.
Yep.
Because if you work on yourself again, emotionally, mentally, relationally, that will have benefit. I know for so many people, it can be, but I can't afford it. But that seems like in the opposite direction. I want to make change now with my finances.
Right.
And I think telling people, of course, you've got to embrace it for yourself, but you are making beneficial steps for your finances if you are working on yourself mentally, emotionally, if you are choosing benefit and aim at well-being, positive gentleness, nurturance for yourself first, because you're not going to be able to get very far if this narrative and inner voice of guilt and shame and maybe even some of those subconscious emotions that we don't even know what they're attached to keep coming in. We're not going to be very successful in the long term with our behaviors. And so looking at, how do I feel about this? What are my emotions? What are my experiences? How is that impacting the decisions I'm currently making? How is it affecting my relationships and the way that I view myself? This is the type of work that I would suggest to people first before sitting down and trying to create some kind of budget that's just like
Absolutely.
A band-aid on a wound.
Absolutely. 100%. I agree with you so much there. And I think that you hit on something that I want to just dig into for another minute here. But like you said that, a lot of people, and myself included, right? We all find ourselves in this place where we're like, okay, we know we need to do something to better ourselves, but that comes with a cost. And we therefore can't get out of our own way. Like we get stuck and we let money drive the bus. And I think this is something that we all do, right? And but it's important to really sit down and have a heart to heart with yourself and be curious around why we are letting kind of money stop us from doing something that might actually be super beneficial for us in the long run. Even if we know logically that it will help us, people have this analysis paralysis, I think, sometimes, and they just can't get over the fact that like therapy is going to cost me money, or coaching is going to cost me money, or doing this group program, or whatever it is that I know it's going to, even going to the gym, right? The gym membership, it's the silly. I mean, it's everything. It's so many things that we know are going to have a longer term benefit for us, but we just get so stuck. And I think that there's again so much more to be explored there, but I'm curious your thoughts on, what prevents us from moving forward in those situations when we let money be the excuse.
Yeah, I think there's so much competition for our attention and what our next step is going to be. That analysis paralysis you're identifying. And I think we can put so much weight and pressure and expectation on ourselves that we do it all and we do it all right now. And I would encourage anyone, myself included, to begin with just one thing. I think we assume or we see other people, it seems like they're all doing all of the things very well constantly. And really, we don't know what's behind the scenes, especially of all the people on social media, but we really can't be all that successful at multiple things at multiple times. I think there has even been research done on like multitasking is a myth. You're not actually multitasking. Like your brain can really only focus on one thing at a time. So I think it's shedding that expectation and giving ourselves permission to just pick up one thing. And I clearing the clutter and identifying one. This is going to sound like an extreme question, but it has been helpful for me and some of the clients that I've worked with. It can really help us distill down, but what is that thing going to be? We can ask ourselves, in my experience right now, what is the worst part? That can really help us know. It feels like, oh, we could talk for hours to our closest friend, and we're just kind of taking all these little tangents, and that's good. I mean, verbally process with the
It's
people that you
helpful.
trust. But if we really want to know how do I tackle it, sometimes we can help break it down and say, but what is the worst part? That can be helpful in getting us to then what's the one thing I'm going to focus on? The worst part of our experiences right now, the thing that feels like it's holding us back, it may not be necessarily the money. It could be the traumas I've experienced in the past. It could be this relationship that I keep feeling this rub and tension with. It could be just all of the demands and stressors on myself. I don't know, but that's something that we can ask ourselves. What's the worst part? And then say, okay, what are the pieces that then could directly target what I'm identifying is the worst part here? So that could mean for some people, it is my own internal narrative. It's the way that I'm treating myself and talking to myself. And so the one thing I'm going to focus on is counseling. I am going to seek professional help in being able to reflect back and aim at well-being in this one area, knowing in the back of my mind that that's going to help me in all of these other areas. But I need to start here because it's hitting the target. It's the root of the problem. I think that is one of the issues when it comes to self-care, kind of across the board, is we don't take the time to wonder, well, what actually is going to meet the need here, right? Because we are, as we mentioned at the top of the episode, physical, emotional, mental, relational, financial people and beings. All of these things make us up. Sometimes when we feel exhausted or we feel stressed or we feel overwhelmed and, oh, I need to practice self-care as if it's just like this task on a to-do list. And
yes,
we do the thing that we think maybe has helped us in the past. Oh, well, I'm going to read a book. I'm going to watch a show. I'm going to go take a bath. And then we're still left feeling depleted. Most of the time, the reason is because we didn't add in that just few extra minutes of curiosity of what's the need attached to the feeling that's happening here. Am I feeling exhausted, depleted? Is it just physically? Do I just need a nap? Sometimes, yes.
Yeah.
Is it emotionally? Is there something that I need to do emotionally for myself to care for myself? Is it financial? Is it relational? Do I need to have that conversation with a friend? I think if we are able to get more at the root of the issue each time we're feeling and identifying, things feel chaotic, we might be able to actually hit the target rather than kind of shooting these arrows that are flying off into the grass. We can actually hit the bullseye with it if we ask ourselves, if we get curious, what's this need attached to a part of my personhood? And then what can I bring into place that's commensurate with that need? Is it emotional? Am I emotionally drained? Then what can I do for myself emotionally? Is it relational? Am I feeling relationally drained? Then I'm going to need to meet the need relationally, and so on and so forth. I think if we can really distill down the actual issue, add in those few extra minutes of pause, curiosity, gentleness, then we can actually see the needle move a bit in our treatment towards self, care for ourself, and well-being.
Like 1,000% agree to all of that. It's so parallel to so many of the things that I talk about here as well. I think about, like, I always use the example in my show around, like, going to Target, because I feel like for so many of us, that's just like it's a socially acceptable way to relax, right? It's socially acceptable to, like, do the shopping, and there's always fun things there. And it's like, what I have been trying to do is, again, put that pause in there. Like, I, as a busy working mom, right, I sometimes, a lot of the time, feel very overwhelmed and just like everything's chaos. And when I have a chance to, like, you know, my husband's taking the kids to the park or something like that, say I have like an hour or an hour and a half to myself, and I'm like, okay, what can I do right now to help me? I could, a lot of times, I either will go for a walk or go for a run, but most of the time I'm like, I'm just going to go to Target, and it doesn't help, right? At the end of the day, I buy, like, you know, some things I need, a couple of things I don't need. And then I end up always feeling that, like, slight guilt afterwards. And it's not helping the root issue here. The root issue is that I feel very overwhelmed and very chaotic, right, in my inner world. And it's my outer world is reflecting that, but I also feel it in my inner world. So if I had just maybe taken that time and instead, you know, spent 30 minutes on a yoga mat and just tried to, you know, calm my nervous system or whatever it is, you know, because every day it's a little bit different. It could be an emotional, like, you know, the emotional drain, or you said the relational drain, the work drain, all of it. It could be anything. If I actually do something during that short period of time that's going to help me, I would have come out of that probably feeling better and less like I'm going to snap, right? Than if I just checked out essentially and, you know, went to Target and bought stuff that I didn't need. So I think that there's, again, this is so universal. You know, that's the example I use, but everybody's got their thing. Everybody has their, like, kind of go-to for, like, you know, checking out when things get hard. And I agree with you. I think if that is working for you, cool. If that's not working for you, then we need to dig a little deeper. We need to, like, and again, with that kindness, that gentleness, take like a few more minutes of that quiet and say, okay, so what is it? Like, what else is there? Like, go another layer deep and be like, where is this coming from? And then again, I hate this as a recovering perfectionist. I'm somebody that, like, wants the answers. I want somebody to just tell me what's going to make me feel better. Mm-hmm. But I have learned that as uncomfortable as that feels, that's not how it works. And this is a personal journey, and we have to all do this discovery for ourselves because it's so unique and it's so customized. And
Yeah.
you have to really start to trust. This is where that self-trust piece to everything comes in, because you have to really start to trust yourself. And for me, this is like the first time ever that I've really started to trust myself. And it's a process.
Yeah. And we're not going to hit the nail on the head every single time, even if we've given ourselves those few minutes to ask, what's the need? How can I meet that need? It still may not, even
Right.
if it's helping a little bit, it's probably your 30 minutes, your 1 hour, even if you get a full weekend, it's still probably not going to resolve
Right.
everything. And maybe we tried something and oh, that wasn't it. That's
Right.
okay. This is all a part of the learning who
Yeah.
we are, what makes us tick, what is going to help. Let me try something different next time. Or maybe that thing will be exactly what I needed the next time around when I'm seeking to care for myself well. And it's this ongoing process and journey that we're never going to exactly know, because life is going to keep shifting and decisions are going to keep coming up and the needs are going to shift and change. And our understanding, even to say this in a bit different of a way, meeting our values is going to look different. And
Yes.
understanding even what do I value in this season and how do I want to meet that value? How do I want to meet this need? It's this process of ongoing curiosity, continuing to cultivate this as a part of our ritual and rhythm of these check-ins. And it's the over time we're going to see kind of that trend, hopefully, of a little bit up and to the right, some dips,
Yeah.
some valleys, some heightened experiences. But I think as we continue to embrace this is part of living this life that I want to be cultivating, we will be better off the more aware of ourselves that we are, the more we are aimed at well-being, even if we're not hitting it perfectly every single time
Yeah.
or ever.
Yeah. And
If our aim is well-being, that is beautiful.
yeah, that is so well said. I just think the way that you put that together and phrased it was beautiful, because again, I am this recovering perfectionist, and I've always thought that, like, okay, once I do this, then everything will be great. And once I find this, next way to fix me, then I'll be perfect, right? Like, all will be good, and all of my anxieties and all my worries, everything will go away, right? And I kept believing that for years and years and years and years. And it's taken me until recently to finally discover that, like, I don't need to fix myself. There's nothing wrong with me in the first place, right? And it's just, how do I find the best way to take care of myself in this moment? Right?
Yes,
Right.
yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh my gosh. Jill, I could talk to you forever. This has been such an amazing conversation. But as we start to wrap up, I'd love to have you tell everybody more about the podcast, what you talk about on the podcast, and how people can find it, and how they can find you and learn more about you and follow you.
Cool. Well, thanks, Megan. Likewise, this has been such a refreshing conversation, and I'm so delighted to be able to be on your show and be a part of your community for today. We also have a podcast called Frugal Friends. It's hosted by myself and Jen Smith, and we talk all things personal finance, but from a whole person perspective. So we're also touching on sustainability and minimalism and simplicity and relationships. It is because money touches all aspects
Everything.
of our
Yep.
lives. Yeah. So we put out episodes 2 times a week, Tuesdays and Fridays. And we also have a newsletter that we've been so excited about. And people can get that at frugalfriendspodcast.com. And we put out the newsletter 3 times a week, giving what's for free that week. If you just need updates on freebies
Oh, that's
and
cool.
savings tips and money mindset hacks and just different things in the Monday, Wednesday, Friday email. So that's free, frugalfriendspodcast.com.
Very cool. I'm going to definitely sign up for that. That's always fun too.
Yay. That'd be
So,
awesome, Megan.
yeah, well, thank you so much. This has been such a pleasure, and I really appreciate you taking the time. Thank you, Jill.
Likewise, thanks, Megan.